I'm Charles Lane, and I think most of you know that already, having seen one or two of these sessions and seen me around. And I am professor of geology at Hardin-Simmons University, which is in Abilene, Texas. And so I've come a fair ways to get here. And the title of the session, Finding a Safe Volcano, is actually something of a takeoff from something that I put in front of my students almost every semester, because it's not so much a matter of finding a safe volcano as it is in terms of finding a safer volcano. And what I do in all of my intro level classes every semester is I pose a question to the students in there, and I say, picture yourself in early 19th century Great Britain, and since I'm Scot-Irish, why I say picture yourself as a Scots person or an Irish person at that point in time. And it is the time of Britain, the Britannia, ruler of the ocean, British Empire flung far and wide. And of course, one of the things that the British were up to with the Scots and the Irish in particular, remember the Irish famines are going to set on in the 40s. But one of the things that the British were up to, especially with the Scots and Irish, were that they were going to export them. Remember, they didn't put them in prisons there in Great Britain. They put them in penal colonies all around the world, and their Botany Bay and the colonization of Australia and all that sort of stuff. So my question to students was, what if the chief penal officer who was busy deporting all of these people was in fact a somewhat demented geologist? And the thing that he was going to do with all these people as he was getting ready to deport them out of the British Isles was, I'm going to sentence you to being deported to a place where you must live on the flank of an active volcano. Not an extinct one, not a dormant one, but one that is an open, active volcano, and Britannia rules the world, and I've got my choice. But I'll let you have your choice of volcanoes and where you would like to go. And it always draws a few befuddled looks from the students when I do that. And then I proceed to tell them a little bit about how people have lived for thousands of years on the flanks of certain volcanoes in relative safety, and yet there are others that you don't want to be within 20 or 30 or 40 miles of. And that's kind of how the whole thing gets started. So it gets to be a thing where the students actually sit up and pay a little bit of attention. It's kind of an unusual thing for them to ponder. I'm going to do something a little unusual today, and there's a certain amount of trepidation that accompanies it, because I'm going to try to explain something to you as lay people, not involved in the geologic profession at all, that I sometimes have a hard time explaining to my second year geology students who've already had a year of geology and a year of chemistry. But I'm going to try and let you be the guinea pigs, and we'll see how this turns out. Okay? But it all has to do with how one can find their way to a safer volcano. Okay? And it works something like this. And this is going to be kind of a torturous route here for a little bit, so kind of stay with me as we go through this. Let me start by showing you a mathematical game that I have seen, actually have done myself from time to time, but that's because I have some interest in that sort of stuff. But a mathematical game, and maybe some of you have seen it as well. I was real big as a kid on getting out my straight edge and my T-square and all this other stuff and drawing figures. And I really like to draw figures with a compass as well. Spin around and make circles. And there's a mathematical game that you can play where you take a circle, that's a circle of a certain size, and you take another circle of a different size, and you see how many of the larger green circles, in this case, you can put around the smaller orange circle so that every green circle touches the orange circle and touches each other, but doesn't overlap. And you get some interesting results, because when the orange and the green circle are of the same size, there's actually an amazing number of green circles you can put around the orange. I don't think I'll tell you the answer either, because I'll let you go home and paint a tennis ball, paint one of your green tennis balls white, put it in the middle of the table, and then start putting the other tennis balls around it. And I think you'll be amazed at how many of the other tennis balls actually go around the one that you painted white in the center. But the upshot of all of this is that if you vary the relative sizes, you may have a situation where your orange circle will have, say, 4 greenish circles around it. And I'm winging this. These things are supposed to be touching here, 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 and here. You may have a situation in which you're having a good time with this. You have one where you have 3 that are supposed to be touching each other. I need to make this smaller. Let's put it in there like that. And of course, if you get the orange one small enough and your green one's large enough, you may only be able to have 2 of them. Are everybody with me so far? I've lost a lot of students at this point, so you're doing very well. Well, now this is a game that's actually played in geometry class from time to time, because you can start talking about the relationships between the centers of these circles, and you can start drawing triangles and right angles and all this sort of stuff. It actually becomes kind of a fun game, and I actually did some of this way back when in a high school geometry class, as a matter of fact. But it turns out that it's a game that's very much worthwhile playing. The next step is to take it into 3 dimensions. And see, here we've got it in 2 on the plane of the board. Now you have to start thinking about bringing things out of the board above and behind. This is where life gets sort of interesting, and this is where physical chemists and crystallographers, geologists who study solid crystal structures, start playing some games. But it turns out that there's still only a certain number of larger circles that are going to fit around smaller ones when you start playing the game in 3 dimensions as well. One of the 3-dimensional forms that results from playing this game is this thing, which is referred to as a tetrahedron, 4-sided form. Okay. All the faces are triangular, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4 faces. You can think of it like a pyramid sitting on the ground like that. And the idea is that the smallest ball, and this is where we kind of get over to here with the triangles business, the idea is that the smallest ball is stuck right in the middle of this tetrahedron, and then the 4 larger balls, their centers are at the points. Okay, so it's a different physical representation. All right? So the form is called a tetrahedron. It has 1 small ball in the center, has 4 larger balls whose centers are at the 4 corners. Now, believe it or not, you guys are staring at the fundamental building block of the inorganic world right here. I hold it in my hand. And it is pervasive. If you walk outside and you pick up a handful of dirt and hold it in your hand, if you could zoom in to a microscopic level, that handful of dirt would be composed of these kinds of things. The rock on which this building is built, actually not so much rock here, but the rock that makes up these mountains around here, is made of this stuff. It is the fundamental building block in nature, and it bears a great resemblance to some of the building blocks that you find in the organic world as well. When we talk about the organic world, we talk about carbon. Right? We're all carbon-based creatures. And you have to go to Star Trek, the original Star Trek, when Spock is doing the mind meld with the Warder. Remember that big blob that was excavating out the bottom of... Were you enough of a Trekkie to... Well, it was pretty hokey, the show, but there's this big silver blob that was going along cutting holes in the rocks, and they called it the Horta, and it was a silicon-based creature instead of Spock, who was a carbon-based creature. But this has great similarities to what carbon can do in the organic world, because the little ball that's at the center is silicon. Now, if you stop and think about it, those of you who've had chemistry, at least think about the periodic chart of the chemical elements. Remember, that was hanging on the wall of the chemistry lab as you walked by in high school and decided, I'm not taking that class, and walked on down the hallway. Well, that periodic chart, if you look at it, you'll find that silicon and carbon are kind of in the same neck of the woods on that chart. And they tend to do some of the same kinds of things in terms of how they get put together. Well, there's a silicon atom sitting right inside the center of this, and there are four oxygen atoms at the corners. So geologists refer to this as the silicon-oxygen tetrahedron. And it is the fundamental building block of the inorganic world. Now, geologists and chemists who are interested in this kind of stuff will represent this in two dimensions just by drawing a triangle of some kind. So they'll put a triangle up here like this, and that's a representation of this silicon oxygen tetrahedron. So it's like setting this thing in here, having it like this. And the only other tricky part of this is that if the silicon oxygen tetrahedron is pointed the other way toward the back of the board, why, they normally will do a representation that looks like this, where they'll take this thing and then they'll have some dashed lines that they bring into the center. And all that is a two-dimensional way to represent the three-dimensional orientation. This thing is point up like this, and this one is point away from you. Okay? So it's you guys are doing great. By this time, I have so many students going, oh! But it's, you know, Carl Sagan, when he was doing Cosmos, reminded us, since we occupy three-dimensional space, we're very comfortable working with one dimension less. We're very comfortable working in two dimensions. The pages of a book are no problem for us. And then he started hypothesizing about the creature who lives in a two-dimensional world, and all they can handle is a line. Right? This sort of stuff. But you know, working in three dimensions is kind of an acquired taste. And my experience is that the longer you live, the better you tend to be at some of these things. You know, you have opportunities to try and pick up something mentally in your head and roll it around and look at it from a different perspective. You know, you buy a new car and you're sitting there thinking about it at night as how you're going to pay for this thing. And, you know, you mentally pick the car up and you look underneath it from each side. So, you know, you can do this sort of stuff, but most of the college students, when they first walk in the door, haven't really tried. So, I mean, I don't see too many blank looks on faces here, so you guys score one for yourself. You're on a roll here. So at any rate, here we've got this silicon-oxygen tetrahedron. Silicon and oxygen together, we call it the silicate, all right, or silicate groups. And that's what the vast majority of the Earth's crust is made up of, silicate minerals. All of these rocks out here across the way that are holding up the walls basically are silicate rocks, and they're put together in various arrangements utilizing this figure right here, the silicon oxygen tetrahedron. Okay? All right, now, got through that point, haven't lost too many people so far. Now, next thing. It turns out that the silicon oxygen tetrahedron, much like carbon in the organic world, can have a tendency to hook up with itself. There's lots of elements out there that do not have any particular desire to hook up with themselves in any kind of repetitive sequence. The silicon oxygen tetrahedron hooks up with itself again very nicely, just like carbon hooks up with itself, or in a somewhat analogous fashion, how carbon hooks up with itself and forms long carbon chains, and that's why you see all those monstrous formulas for even sugars, simple sugars. Not to mention hydrocarbon products, this kind of stuff. So at any rate, it turns out you can have a silicon-oxygen tetrahedron that is sort of, I hesitate to use the word floating around in a solid, but that's kind of how you can picture it, is floating around in a solid material, and it's not hooked up to any other thing like it. In other words, it's not hooked up to another silicon-oxygen tetrahedron. Those of you who've had a college course in geology and recognize the name olivine. Olivine is a silicate mineral. It's olive green in color. And the silicon oxygen tetrahedra in it are like this. There's one over here, and there's one off over here, and 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 none of them are connected to one another. They're all independent of one another. That gives olivine a certain property when it gets melted. Okay, we'll come back to that in just a sec. At the other extreme, you guys all know quartz. Right? All know the mineral quartz, grains of sand at the beach, all that kind of stuff. The thing about the mineral quartz is that the silicon oxygen tetrahedra, every last corner that you have here is in essence hooked to a corner of another silicon oxygen tetrahedron. So there's a spectrum here from a silicon oxygen tetrahedron that is by itself, will not hook up with another one. You can get a situation where a tetrahedron hooks up to just one other tetrahedron at a point. The mineral is epidote, by the way. Pistachio green mineral is the most common one of those. And then you can get in a situation where you can start hooking up in a fashion that might look like this. And we'll put those two up and this one down. And see that any given one of these has two of its corners hooked up. A lot of these greenish shaded rocks that you see in the walls and all over the place here, a lot of the minerals that are those green minerals have the silicon oxygen tetrahedra hooked up like this, and they get hooked up in long chains. So some of these things are off by themselves. They don't hook up with one another. They'll hook up with other things, but they don't hook up with one another. Okay? Some of them will share a single corner. Some of them will share two corners. Some of them will share three corners. And in the case of quartz, they'll share all four corners. All right, here's, in essence, the punchline. First go-around now. Right. What this means is, in a real sense, it's an analogous situation to trying to maintain a low-fat diet in your body and keep away from hardening your arteries and clogging your arteries. What happens when your arteries get clogged is you have all of those fats and high-fat diet things that you're not supposed to be eating. And the carbon in that is hooked to another carbon, to another carbon, to another carbon, to another carbon. You get this long string of carbons hooked together, and they just kind of string out in your vein and constrict it. Same thing happens, by the way, going back to another geologic hat that I would wear, same thing happens in the oil patch. When you pull oil out of the ground, mixed in with it are waxy hydrocarbons, paraffin. Paraffin that you use to seal your jellies. Okay? That paraffin wax you use to seal your jellies. That's a petroleum hydrocarbon. That's a petroleum hydrocarbon, and the carbons are just all hooked together in this long chain. That's what makes it a wax. It makes it waxy. Same kind of thing happens with carbons in fats that act to block your arteries. What petroleum refiners try to do is they take a long chain of carbons, and they want to make gasoline to put in your car. They take a long chain of carbons and they break them. They break the carbons every so often. They only want five or six carbons in a row, six or seven carbons in a row, because that's gasoline. You get longer carbons, that's more like asphalt. So they break the carbons. You want to do the same thing too in terms of your diet. You don't want long carbon chains, those nasty fats. You want to have things where the carbon that you ingest is in shorter segments. It, in a sense, is a very good analogy to what happens here in the inorganic world with these silicon oxygen tetrahedra. Because what you don't want is these things hooking all together. You don't want silicon oxygen tetrahedrons hooked to all four corners. In fact, it'd be nice if they were like olivine out here, or they didn't hook to one another at all, because the result in the inorganic world is in essence, the same as the result in the organic world with respect to blocking your arteries and the disastrous results of that. The situation is the same in the inorganic world. If you have minerals that, when melted, tend to string out, if we will, like these carbons, they tend to block the artery, in this case, the volcanic pipe to the top of the volcano, with absolutely devastating consequences, whereas the ones that don't hook together and stay as independent silicon oxygen tetrahedra produce an entirely different effect. Actually, I got through most all the chemistry I wanted right there, and that wasn't so bad. That wasn't so bad. But you're with me on that? It really is kind of interesting, the analogies, and there is an interesting similarity between silicon in the inorganic world and carbon in the organic world. They have what we call a valence state of 4. They can hook into things in 4s very easily, both of them. Okay? And the carbon is even a little nastier in some respects because it has a tendency to hook to itself in direct fashions. Here we kind of share oxygens and just go on down these chains or down the lines. But the result is very much the same. The result is very much the same. And what it does is it affects the viscosity of this rock when it's melted. All right, so now everybody's into viscosity. You let your husband change the oil in the car, right? Or take it down to the quick lube. That stuff. So if we say 10W40 motor weight, does that mean anything at all to you?
Yeah, well, I know the meaning. That's about all.
Okay. Okay.
It has to do with viscosity.
Sure, it has to do with the viscosity. All right, now do you know which end? You're old enough to remember before multi-vis motor weights. I'm old enough to remember before multi-vis motor weights. Remember back when you were younger and your father might have been changing the oil maybe twice a year in the car, once as summer was getting ready, once as winter was setting on? He was changing it because we didn't have multi-vis motor oils. And so in the summer, what would he go to? 40? That's a great number, right? You go to 40. If you lived in El Centro or down in the Imperial Valley, California, you went to a 50 in the summer. And then in the winter, 5, 10, maybe 20, depending on how mild the place was. All right. And, of course, the whole idea was that in the winter you wanted that oil to flow more like water so that the cold weather would not congeal it. Make sure your engine ran. And then just the opposite sort of situation in the summer when it was so hot, you wanted that thicker oil because the engine was going to heat it up anyway. Right? So you wanted something that would lubricate the parts. We can talk about volcanoes, as a matter of fact, in exactly the same kinds of terms. Whether or not it's a low weight or high weight, low vis, high vis volcano. We can talk about that in the same sense and tie it directly to this kind of stuff. Something that you'd think of as a low vis or, you know, a 5 or 10 weight motor oil, something that would flow nicely. That would be something where these silicon oxygen tetrahedra are not hooked together. And a high weight would be where they're hooked together very tightly. So you start looking around and you see volcanoes in places like the Hawaiian Islands, Kilauea. You guys have all seen Kilauea on the news over the years. The volcanic islands of Iceland would be another example. And when you're looking at those kinds of scenes, you are looking at a low vis or low motor weight motor oil at work. People have lived on Iceland for a very long time. Polynesians have lived on the Hawaiian Islands for a very long time. And there is danger to living there, but is it really life-threatening? When's the last news flash you've heard from Hawaii that somebody was killed on the Big Island?
It was their own fault. They just got over the edge.
they were up visiting the summit crater. Whoops! and fell over the edge. Or, you know, when is the latest report of mass death and destruction out of Iceland? There is no question, and that's why what you're talking about is finding a safer volcano. There's no question the volcano is dangerous, but you can go to Kilauea. I can go to Kilauea. Tom has probably been to Kilauea. Been to Kilauea?
Mm-hmm.
Hold up your hand, Tom, and say hi, Tom. In case you guys haven't seen him, and I think most of you have, but Tom Pearson, sitting back over here, is kind of an added bonus today because he is by trade a volcanologist and works at the Cascades Volcanic Observatory down in Vancouver. And one of his great delights is being part of the USGS first response team around the planet. And last year you were at Pinatubo in the Philippines, and the year before that he was up at Redoubt up in Alaska. He wasn't going to come to this because he knew it'd be too boring for him. But I talked him into it anyway so that he would be able to share some things from his background with you as well. But he can go to Hawaii, I can go to Hawaii, you can go to Hawaii. Of course, we can all go up fairly close to the summit of Kilauea and have a look. But if a lava flow was coming after us in Hawaii, the odds are that we could probably walk backwards down the hill taking photographs of it as we go, if you're so inclined. Which is one of the things that separates geologists from other people. Is that they're the ones that are walking backwards down the hill taking pictures of the advance. And yes, you don't want to stumble, but the odds are that you could probably walk. Some of them you may want to run, but for the most part, you could even walk back down the hill away from the lava flow and take pictures as you go. You certainly don't want to step into it at the temperatures that it has, but you can be in fairly close proximity. Who was the guy from the GS that was killed at St. Helens?
David Johnson.
David Johnson was killed at St. Helens on the May 18th eruption. How far away was he?
5 miles.
He was 5 miles away, and he could not get out of the way. He could not get out of the way in time at St. Helens. Therein is a totally different situation, and it's explained in fairly simple chemistry terms by the fact that at St. Helens, you have all of these little things hooked together. The rock type changes as a result of that. Instead of basalt, or as our British friends say, basalt, instead of basalt, the rock is an andesite. Again, those of you that had a geology class, instead of being that black basalt, why it's a greenish, grayish colored rock. But the principal difference in terms of making the volcano dangerous, principal difference is that these little silicon oxygen tetrahedra are hooked together. A lot more of them are hooked together a lot more than at a Kilauea or at a Surtsey, say in Iceland. And the difference is staggering as a result, because this stuff, as it in essence works its way up as a lava, as a liquid, works its way up through the volcanic structure, is going to clog the arteries. It will clog the arteries. And if there is still an abundant lava generation going on, the result is going to be like having your pressure cooker blow up on you. Because it will keep going and going and going until at some point the whole thing blows up. And then you can be like Dave Johnson and be 5 miles away. And there were some people even a little farther away than that that were affected, weren't there?
Up to about 12 or 15 miles.
Even 12 or 15 miles away that were killed by that. You just could not get away fast enough. That's not even necessarily the most dangerous example. How far was it from Pele down to St. Pierre on Martinique? What was that distance? Do you remember?
I think it was about 9 or 10 kilometers, or about 5 or 6 miles.
5 or 6 miles at Martinique. The interesting part were some of the ships, some of them as far as 5 or 6 miles out, I think, in the harbor. I don't know if you've heard that story. The year was about 1902, and Martinique in the Caribbean. Nice vacation spot. I want to go there sometime. You've been there.
No, I haven't.
Oh, I found one place you haven't. Martinique in the Caribbean. The largest town, St. Pierre, 25, 30,000 people, something about like that. And as I recall, most everybody on Martinique was in town because there was a national election going on at that point in time. And Mount Pelee was acting up and getting ready to blow. And unfortunately, Mount Pelee composed the materials a lot more like St. Helens, where all of these things were hooked together. And when the cork came out of the bottle there, there was an absolutely devastating event that happened. Geologists refer to it as a nuit ardente, the French for a fiery cloud. And when that volcano blew up, this fiery cloud swept down from the volcano toward the town of St. Pierre. And it was literally the gates of hell opened wide, because this was an incandescent cloud. This was temperatures in the thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. And it was not a lava flow. It was not an ash fall. It was a roiling, boiling, glowing cloud of molten material. Estimates of speed. What's the last estimate of speed you've heard?
Well, those things usually move at least 100 miles an hour.
You can't run fast enough. You cannot run fast enough from a nuit ardente. There were some nuit ardente type of things at St. Helens.
Mm-hmm. Small ones.
Small ones. But this one was a monster, and you couldn't run fast enough. I think that they even estimated some of this was more on the order of 160, 170 miles an hour. It's like you couldn't run fast enough. It rolled over the town of St. Pierre, and it annihilated the entire population, 25, 27,000 people. The only person recorded having survived that was a prisoner in the local hoosegow who was sleeping it off that night. And evidently the hoosegow was below ground level. And the thing just rolled right across the top. And it took 4 days or so before they finally found this guy. But the cloud rolled down that 5 or 6 miles and then rolled another 4 or 5 or 6 miles out across the roads, which is where the ships at the time were parked, anchored, and burned them up as well. 25,000 people in that glowing cloud.
Does that happen
at Vesuvius too? That's another type of thing at Vesuvius, although interestingly enough, the destruction of Pompeii, those people actually had more time. The reason that Pompeii is as excavated as it is that it basically was buried in ash. And who is it? Pliny the Elder ultimately got caught in that, but he has a history of that day. And there was a fair amount of time for people to leave there. Now, Hercynium, that was a little different story. They were closer, right?
Yeah, Herculaneum was on the coast to the west of the volcano. They were hit by the hot mud flows.
Yeah, the hot mud flows, the lahar type of things. Well, not, I guess, if you don't have a lot of snow and ice. But there was water there.
Yeah, may have been a crater lake, but they also tend to generate their own intense thunderstorms.
Sure, as they go along. That was a different story. Those folks didn't have, weren't quite as fortunate, we say fortunate, but the folks at Pompeii had more time available to them. So there are, in fact, safer volcanoes to hang out around, if you have to do it. And since the world's ocean floor, the world's ocean basins, are composed principally of basalt, then places like Hawaii, or as I was corrected, 2 years ago I was in Hawaii during the summer and met a Polynesian who told me that Polynesian is a terribly phonetic language, and that I was mistaken, that I was in Hawaii. Hawaii. And hit every last one of the vowels. Hit each vowel. So I stood corrected. So if you go to Hawaii and you see a Polynesian, you want to impress them, say, gee, it's wonderful here in Hawaii. But at any rate, someplace like Hawaii or someplace like Iceland, those are the kinds of places where, all things considered, you're in much, you're relatively much safer if you in fact are living on the flanks of some kind of active volcano. The Cascades of the Pacific Northwest are a very dangerous place, because it is a place where the basalts of the oceanic crusts and the granitic crust of the continent meet and collide, which is why the Cascades are here, with the subduction of the ocean plate causing these Cascade Mountains to form. But granites are made up of quartz and orthoclase feldspar. If any of you come visit Texas and come to Austin and see the state capitol buildings, this huge pink building, it's pink because of the orthoclase feldspar. Thing of it is, though, is that the orthoclase feldspar and the quartz are both what geologists refer to as tectosilicates, where all four corners, for the most part, are shared with other silicon oxygen tetrahedra. So the basalt mixing with this granitic material in terms of the subduction and the melting of the rock and then the rise of this magma back up toward the surface there, it's a totally different animal, totally different character to it than what you find in Hawaii or in Iceland. And because of that, the pore throats get clogged and the volcanoes will erupt violently, very violently. The Italian volcanoes are the same way. The volcanic mountains of Indonesia are the same way. Even though that's an island chain, the plate tectonic setting is the same, where there is subduction of an ocean plate. And there's enough of an explosive nature to some of that. Although Krakatoa, which went off in 1883, that was a somewhat different event. That was what's called a phreatic eruption. And Krakatoa blew up because millions of gallons of seawater poured into a magma chamber and immediately flashed to steam, blew up, blew half the island away, killed thousands of people throughout Indonesia by creating an enormous tidal wave which rolled over the islands. Woke people up a long ways off, including a British captain pulling duty on one of those remote islands in the South Atlantic. He thought he heard cannons going off in the South Atlantic. He woke people up all over Australia, which was a long ways off as well. But a guy is recorded as having been heard in the South Atlantic. So there are, in fact, differences in volcanoes. And people have successfully lived places like Hawaii or Iceland and coexisted with volcanoes for a fairly long time. In other situations, perhaps civilizations have been wiped out by volcanic activity. You do know the story of Pompeii, but the Thebes... how far back? 1500 BC? Getting out of your field there. This is great. The best defense against having another geologist in the crowd is to just attack him and don't give him any room to breathe. And so I'll hit Tom and that way stay on the offensive all the time. But the legends of Atlantis and the lost civilization of Atlantis, perhaps wiped out by an enormous eruption in the Greek Isles back about 1500 BC. So there are better and worse places to be if you're going to be living someplace close to a volcano. And it all ties basically to a fairly fundamental type of chemistry, the business of this silicon oxygen tetrahedron, and in terms that you guys have been used to all your lives, viscosity. Whether you have a low viscosity or high viscosity. I mean, there are, and Tom will tell you, there are obviously other kinds of things that enter in or are complicating factors, but at a fundamental level, that's really how it works. So you could have answered that demented British penal colony officer when he asked you, which volcano do you want to go to? He said, well, I want to go to Hawaii anyway. and live in comparative safety by living in a place like that where the lava that comes out, and that's actually, that's something that you want. You want to live someplace where the lava flows. And, you know, it's an interesting type of thing because I would wager that prior to 1980, most of you would have thought that, ooh, I don't want a lava flow to get me. If I'm standing around a volcano and you remember the images of Kilauea and standing up at the edge of that crater and the geologist is out there. And you can tell the geologist out there because they're the ones that are walking out and they've got those big moon boot things on. But they might be walking out there with this long-handled stick and there's this little cup that's inverted and they're holding it out over here to collect these gases. This goes back a long ways, but it was always kind of fun to think about the fact that, you know, you're walking up to the summit of an active volcano there and these gases are coming out and this person's got a 10-foot long handle. Yeah, 10 feet, right? And Tom will tell you, things are a little more sophisticated than that nowadays. But I think there's, you know, since St. Helens, there's been kind of a change in how you perceive things. Because these people, Dave Johnson for one, were a doggone long ways away from the volcano compared to standing at the lip of Kilauea. And they couldn't get out of there fast enough.
Do the volcanoes in Hawaii create like tremors when lava flow starts and stops? I'm curious because there's telescopes being
up on Mauna Kea.
Yeah, on some of the other islands. I was just wondering whether any tremors would affect those telescopes. It's
actually kind of an interesting deal because Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea are actually on the same island. They're on the big island. Mm-hmm. And Kilauea is on the flank of Mauna Loa, and all that lava is running back down southeast-ish. And so Mauna Kea is back off over this way, but they're actually on the same island. And Mauna Kea is where all of those observatories are placed. And it's a great place to put an observatory because you're 14,000 feet up in the middle of the Pacific, and the air is very clear. But Kilauea was perhaps one of the most predictable volcanic events in modern times. Started back early 70s is when it got kicked off. And the tremors, the earthquakes were a dead giveaway and a very nice giveaway as far as earth scientists were concerned. Because with the seismograph, you can work, and you can work not only on how far away an earthquake is and whether or not there was compression towards you or tension away from you by the movement of the rocks. You can also work on how deep the earthquake is. And when the tremors started, they were way down, 50 kilometers or something like that. And the geologists just kept track of them because the tremors were at 50 kilometers and then they were at 45 and then they were 40. And it was just the magma rising. And so it was great because that's just the way nature worked it out. But it made all the seismologists and volcanologists look awfully good because they said, "Well, we know the Kilauea is going to go off here in the next few weeks, and basically we're right on it." And some of those tremors were substantial. I don't know what the effect is necessarily on the observatories now. I don't think the tremors that have gone on in the last few years have been very large, threes and fours perhaps. And I don't think they've had much of an effect over at Mauna Kea.
With all of that is known, then, the action in the earth and seismograph and all that, then why were those observers that close to Mount St. Helens, knowing what kind of material or viscosity it contained, or did they not know that?
Tom, would you like a shot
sure.
at that?
They knew it. They knew it had the potential for doing what it did. Most of the volcanoes in the Cascades, though, tended not to erupt sideways.
Which
just shoot straight up.
Took these guys by surprise.
And the St. Helens eruption did go sideways. Although, and they did, in fact, Dave Johnston was one of the key proponents of arguing that this eruption probably was going to go sideways.
I was copying the misery reports in Shelton, and I have the video of David Johnston talking about, and if I was standing right here, I would not survive. And he was at the ridge. And then I have the video, you know, I've got hours of video of it. And so he predicted that he could not be there during the big eruption, and he didn't.
Well, geologists also suffered from a malaise that I guess that affects other people too, who are fairly regularly exposed to hazardous situations. You start tending to discount the hazard, and I think that was probably part of the situation. They had requested from the National Guard an armored vehicle to be placed at the site, some sort of a bunker, but there wasn't time or money to actually get it in place.
It's interesting, Dixie Lee Ray was the governor, and she was a scientist, and mm-hmm. she had proposed these zones along with the government's mm-hmm. recommendations, but the public and the politicians kept fighting her, making her smaller, and that sort of...
That's right.
And it was probably fortunate we had a scientist governor at the time, because if we had a more political governor, president of Weston, what she did, she had some. Mm-hmm.
Let me, as we continue some of the discussion, let me pass around... And take a look at this page in this book. This is an environmental geology textbook along with me, but it's the Big Island, Hawaii, Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa, and here's the Kilauea and the green going down on to the southeast. But down here is a photograph of, and I forget the name of it, it's the Royal Garden subdivision, and you will see the streets cross-hatched in here and put up. And then the black, of course, are the lava flows that have come across the subdivision. And down here is a picture of one of the houses burning. But as this book went to press, which was, the last edition, 1992, so I think she would have updated it, they still had not put in any kind of zoning laws down in this southeastern part of the Big Island of Hawaii. To keep people from trying to put subdivisions and homes in here. To sort of enforce your point, your economic development. Go ahead.
I was just going to bring up another analogy that we sometimes use to add to what you said here about the interlocking tetrahedron, silica tetrahedron. And that is that gas plays a very good part in these eruptions. Mm-hmm. Cascade-type volcanoes. And in Hawaii, well, first of all, in any magma or lava that's still underground, there's a lot of gas dissolved in it. And as it comes up toward the surface of the earth and the pressure is decreased, that gas starts bubbling out of solution and becoming bubbles and escapes to the surface in a lava that's runny enough for it to get out.
If it's a low viscosity lava, it runs like water.
Lava.
Bubbles
it's like
come
when,
out very nice.
When you uncork or uncap a bottle of beer, and then all of a sudden the bubbles start streaming from well down in the liquid, start streaming toward the top, and then that gas escapes. What happens in these lavas here that are more viscous, or pasty, thick, sticky kind of lava, as that gas starts coming out of solution, the bubbles can't rise because the material is too viscous, so they're basically trapped in the material. And if the pressure is released quickly enough, that lava is pushed toward the surface quickly enough, it holds in there, building pressure until finally it explodes. And that's actually what the driving force behind these explosions. It's all these zillions of little bubbles that suddenly just burst apart.
They've been under great pressure, and now they're at atmospheric pressure, and their capacity for expansion is extraordinary.
And if you've ever seen pieces of pumice, pieces of pumice are this frozen froth of high viscosity lavas.
Bubble froth.
That are just full of bubbles in these.
Yeah.
The old lava hand soap.
Yes. Yeah.
Grind that pumice up.
Can I back to your tetrahedrons?
Sure.
Does the ability of a tetrahedron to match, you know, to form the strings, does that determine the hardness? Is that a hardness quality necessarily, or is it?
Not necessarily. It turns out olivine on Mohs hardness scale is up in the 6-7 range, just like the feldspars and the quartz. Mm-hmm. And one's at one end of the scale and one's at the other.
This means how it flows.
Now what it does often do, although those are two sort of exceptions to the rule as well. Sometimes it determines whether or not something is more likely to fracture rather than cleave along certain planes.
And it does determine the melting temperature.
And there is a
the quartz, the ones that are mostly silica, actually melt at a lower temperature.
Well, you're stealing my Friday talk now. Yes, and it has a dramatic difference on melting temperatures, which also plays a part. The olivine in those basaltic lava flows, one of the things very nice about it is this thing is very, very hot, and very, very hot at Earth's surface temperatures. And I mean, you know, you're under atmospheric temperatures and pressures, and this stuff is still over 1,000 degrees centigrade, even over 1,000 degrees centigrade, whereas things down toward quartz are much cooler, and of course they, having a lower temperature of crystallization, they get up close to the surface of the Earth and start cooling off, and the viscosity sets in, and all of this becomes a bigger problem. And the volcano becomes much more explosive.
I was wondering if you're very familiar with Mount Lassen in Northern California, and do we have the same conditions that you have in the Cascade?
Lassen actually is, as far as geologists are concerned, Mount Lassen is as good an active volcano as any.
We live right in the neighborhood.
It was 1914 through about 1921 that Lassen was going off. So, I mean, as far as geologists are concerned, that's active. Mount Baker, and Tom, you can jump back in here too, but as I recall, prior to St. Helens erupting in 80, a lot of people were betting on Baker. And there's actually some betting on Glacier Peak, which isn't that far away from us.
It's just over the ridge.
Yeah, it's real close.
Yeah, it's real close to Holden.
Are they doing any seismic investigations of Glacier?
There's a seismic network that covers the whole Cascade range, including Lassen Peak, which is part of the Cascades.
Exactly.
We go all the way down there. Yeah. And that's maintained and centered in the University of Washington Geophysics Department. So if earthquakes, the kind that signal the onset of volcanic activity, any one of the Cascade volcanoes, if they were to start, they would be picked up on the seismic net. And then at that point, what they would do is they would rush in and put some portable instruments, many of them, around that particular volcano so that they could then zero in on exactly where they're occurring. They can essentially hear these earthquakes with a net the way it is, but they can't locate them very precisely with a relatively few number of stations. So what they do is they have reason to suspect something's going to happen, and they can put in additional instruments and get very precise.
Are there?
Well, St. Helens gave a lot of warning. It was 2 months of bubbling and gurgling.
Well, from March to May, basically was all they had. Although some volcanoes give less than a week.
Yeah.
Warning.
Yeah. There were several small eruptions
There was a, March 30th eruption that was
The first eruption was within a couple of weeks of the onset of the earthquake. Small eruption.
So it had been quiet for 125
Early. Virtually all of the Cascade volcanoes have had small eruptions in the first half of the 19th century.
Yeah, yeah. Virtually all of them. Any of you Portlanders? No Portlanders here?
Portland?
Yeah.
Across the river.
Oh, well, you're not that close to Mount Hood then. You won't be scared to talk to Tom about Mount Hood. But even Mount Hood.
What about the Mexican volcanoes? What kind are they? Are there any other volcanoes in Central America besides Mexico?
There are volcanoes in Central America. There are volcanoes in South America. The Andes are essentially a volcanic chain. And actually, I'm going to show one or two of the Mexican volcanoes, not tomorrow because I have the day off, but Friday, take you through some of them. The classic example of a cinder cone, Petrocotin, is a Mexican volcano, and talk a little bit about that. But some of them are large. And speaking of enormous disasters, I should say one of Tom's things is he specializes in the debris flows and the mud flows that get started as a result of volcanic activity. But there was a debris flow of enormous proportions in South America. What year?
At Ruiz?
Yeah.
85.
And he had a chance to look at some of that, and there have been some enormous debris flows that have had devastating results for the people that live in the high Andes. And so, you know, we're on part of the Ring of Fire, and it's not called that by accident. We can go all the way from the south end of South America up along the west coast of North America through the Aleutian Chain. There are some monstrous volcanoes in the Aleutians. It's just that nobody's ever noticed. or cared much, and then back down the Pacific through all of Japan, the Philippines, and Indonesia,
Siberia,
even the Kamchatka Peninsula area, and up in there. It's the Ring of Fire, and amazing things happen. Tom and I both subscribe to magazines that keep us posted on geologic events, and got any trivia information on how often a volcano is doing something around the ring?
Well, the Smithsonian Institution publishes a volcano watch type publication, and on any given week of the year, there are a dozen or two volcanoes in eruption somewhere.
Doing something.
So there's always volcanoes.
Always volcanoes.
And the other thing that I've always been fascinated by is that, and this is a piece of trivia I picked up someplace, but somewhere in that ring, there is an earthquake of at least magnitude 3, which isn't a real large earthquake, but if you're standing on top of it, you might be able to feel that. But there's an earthquake of at least magnitude 3 going off every 11 seconds.
Can earthquakes set off a volcano?
Well, St. Helens is kind of an interesting example in that respect, too. The bulge on the northeast side, how high did that bulge before that thing slid?
I don't remember the figure, but
it was amazing.
110 feet or something?
I thought it was 100 yards. But... Well, that was an immediate predecessor. That was an immediate predecessor to that northeast face blowing out. But that thing bulged, and then all of that material took a slide. And
the earthquake. There were people flying over the volcano.
Right.
They were taking pictures, and they saw everything get kind of jiggly.
Yeah.
Which turned out to be, that was the moment the earthquake was occurring.
The earthquake occurred.
And that probably was what triggered the landslide, which then uncorked the champagne bottle that somebody had shook up.
Yeah. And see, the landslide...
And as soon as landslide uncorked it... It
was out. So there was a definite relation.
So should we go visit that area, or should we?
Tom will be happy to take you. I'm going there after my tour here. Let me throw one other thing at you before we leave. This was a lot of fun. There is a book. I'm hawking one of the books over there. There is a book over in the bookstore, and you can also get it at B. Dalton and Walden Books, all this sort of stuff. John McPhee, The Control of Nature. John McPhee has been writing about nature for a very long time, and he is very, very good at it. He's very good at it. I first read him back in the 60s when he read about now Senator Bill Bradley's basketball career at Princeton. He had a book entitled A Sense of Where You Are. And after that, he switched into the nature world, and he's written things like In Suspect Terrain, The High Plains, Basin and Range, a lot of it with geological kinds of overtones, which is why I enjoy it. But he's got a book here entitled The Control of Nature. And again, it's sort of, you need to kind of put it in quotes. There are three essays in here. One has to do with the Army Corps of Engineers in their never-ending fight to control the Mississippi River and to keep it from breaking out and going into the Chafalaya, which would be devastating to New Orleans. It'd kind of leave New Orleans high and dry. It is a monstrous, monstrous problem, and the vast majority of people have no idea about it. None whatsoever. The second one in here is an article on the debris flows that come out of the San Gabriel Mountains on the north side of Los Angeles. If you've been in Los Angeles, those communities up there, La Cunada, Flint Ridge, have historically suffered through devastating debris flows where heavy rains have brought these mudslides down into the basin. The winters of 69, 70, 71 were particularly bad. The third article in here is about what you do if you are an otherwise sort of disentangled physicist in Iceland. You wait for a volcano to go off, and then you figure out how to save a town from it. And this is the story of how people in Iceland, on the island of Heimaey, back in the 70s, 73 I think, took to the harbor and diverted the mountain, diverted the lava flows by pumping water not against just the edge, but actually climbing up on top of the lava flow and pumping water on this lava flow to divert it in order to save their harbor, because it's the best harbor in the south side of Iceland. The story of men who get up on top of this thing wearing insulated boots and walking on a crust an inch and a half thick with molten lava underneath it. Absolutely fascinating story.
Thank you.
Yes, well, thanks for coming. This was fun.